Welcome to the Leadership Playbook, the show where successful leaders share what they learned to get to where they are. This podcast is an offshoot of the Albers Executive Speaker Series. I'm your host, Joe Phillips, the Dean of Seattle University's Albers School of Business and Economics. Welcome to this edition of the Albers Executive Speaker Series. This evening, we're very delighted to welcome Dr. Barry Posner from Santa Clara University. Barry is the Accoliti Endowed Professor of Leadership at the Levy School of Business at Santa Clara, and he served for 12 years as the dean there, but he's not doing that anymore. He's the department chair now. And this quarter, he is also serving as visiting distinguished professor in the Albers School while he's on his sabbatical from Santa Clara. Barry has been named as one of the nation's top management and leadership educators by the International Management Council, recognized as one of the top 50 leadership coaches in America, and ranked among the most influential HR thinkers in the world by HR Magazine. He's the co-author of the award-winning and best-selling leadership book, The Leadership Challenge, now in its seventh edition. It has been read by millions and translated into more than 20 foreign languages. It has been listed among the top 100 business books of all time, receiving both Book of the Year honors by the American Council of Healthcare Executives and the Critics' Choice Award from the nation's book review editors. Barry has also co-authored a number of other award-winning practical books on leadership, at least 15 and counting. He is an internationally renowned scholar who has also published more than 100 research and practitioner-oriented articles in such highly regarded publications as the Harvard Business Review, the Academy of Management Journal, and the Journal of Applied Psychology. The title of his talk tonight is Making Extraordinary Things Happen, Leadership Makes the Difference. So please join me in welcoming Barry Posner to Seattle U.
Nice to be here. Thank you very much. I want to share some ideas with you for the next couple hours, and I want to get you to interact a little bit with me and with each other. So let's start by this doing this. Think about a real person that you know that's a manager, right? Somebody, you know somebody that's a manager? I don't need to know their name, but think about somebody that you know that's a manager and put them in the palm of your hand for a moment, okay? Got somebody in mind? Now, think about a person that you know that's a leader, real person that you know that's a leader, and put them in the other hand for a moment. So I asked you to think about a manager and I asked you to think about a leader. My question is, did you think about the same person or did you think about two different people? Isn't it interesting? We haven't even defined these terms yet. And yet, most of us think that somehow there's managers and there's leaders and they're somehow quite separate. Now, if this were a should question, should we be thinking about two different people or should we be thinking about, at least in an ideal world, should we be thinking about the same person? What do you think? We probably ought to be thinking about the same person. On the other hand, it's interesting when you look at the words themselves, managers and leaders, they lead us to some interesting differences. When you think about a person that's a manager, if you look up the word in a dictionary, it has to do with, actually the Italian definition has to do with a menagerie, the handling of horses, the handling of animals. In Spanish, manos, hands. You get your hands around things as managers. You hold on to things, try and control things. If you look up the word leader in a dictionary, it comes from a Middle English word, to lead in. It means to travel, to guide, to move forward. And all of a sudden, you can see the tension between holding on and letting go. And you know, I didn't make up these words. I just use them. The truth of the matter is, however, when you look in a dictionary, you'll find that the word leader is not capitalized. It doesn't refer to a position or a place in an organization. It's really more of an attitude and a sense of responsibility to move forward. Things are not going to be any different if you just stay where you are. At least at Santa Clara University, it comes naturally. I don't know here about Seattle University. Bob, does that come naturally? At any rate, I want to share with you a couple thoughts. First of all, if I were to ask you to think of a bold, audacious assumption under which everything that you know is everything that you know as a leader would be based upon. This is what I would say it is. I would say to everyone here in this room, you make a difference. Of course, that's a trick question, isn't it? Because the question is, what kind of difference do you make? And really the question is, what kind of difference do you want to make? We'll all make a difference. But are we making the difference that we want to make? And to be able to answer that question requires us to be thinking today, to live our lives forward, is to be asking ourselves, well, what difference do I want to make? How do I want to be remembered? And the clarity that we have about those questions allows us to really to achieve the audacious goals of this university, to be that kind of innovative, bold person who's going to make a difference for the world, society, the planet, to live a life forward. Now, some of you have told me that you've been working on leadership all your lives. So, and some of you haven't lived as long as I have, right? So we have different amounts of experience. But let me ask you this. Whatever you know about leadership, whatever you know about leadership, how did you come to know whatever it is that you now know? So you've observed people. You've observed people leading. And you've observed some people who do a really great job, and you've observed some people who do less than a great job. Yeah, exactly. So we learn about leadership through observation, through watching other people. I mean, some of you have parents, some of you are parents, but you could ask the same question, how did your parents learn to lead? And they learned by observing other parents, observing their own parents. But there's another way that parents learn to lead in the same way that, or the parents learn to parent and leaders learn to lead. What's another way that we learn to lead? Through our own experience, that's right. In fact, your parents have been experimenting on you, learning about how to be a good parent. So we learn through our own experiences, and we've all had the same two teachers, haven't we? Their names are trial and error, and we learn through experience. And we do some things, and they get the intended results, and we continue doing them. We do some things, and they don't have the intended results. Now, for the young people here, I'm talking about your dating. Some things work and some things don't. Things that work, you keep repeating. Though things that don't work, you try something new. And some of you are still experimenting, clearly, because you're all alone. So we learn through experience. We learn through the experience of others, and we learn through our own experience. There is a third way that we learn about leadership. Anybody know what that third way is? Anybody ever gone to school, taken a class, read a book on leadership? Well, this is the third way that you learn about leadership. You learn about it through studying about it. But in essence, what you're studying are really the experiences of other people. As a researcher, as a scholar, what do I share? I share with you the results of my experience and my experience with other people who lead and what we've learned from those people. And so what I want to make is kind of a foundational note that says experience is the best teacher. And what we've discovered when we do studies of college students, is that those who have the most opportunities to lead end up being better leaders than those who don't. In our research, the question that we've asked people is to tell us about your experience, not just any experience. We've asked people to tell us about the time that they've been at their personal best as a leader, whatever that meant. And whether we talk to teenagers or senior citizens, whether we talk to tall people or short people, green people or blue people, people in the United States or outside the United States, what they tell us is more similar than it is different about the times that they've been at their personal best. And had we more time, I would ask you to be opening up that kind of internal window and be thinking about, what would I say my time was when I was at my personal best? Maybe yours would be like one young man who was in my class not too long ago, Ignacio, who missed the first week of classes, and that doesn't make me very happy as an instructor. And so when he came the second week, I started to give him a hard time because I didn't know why he wasn't there. He would tell me that he wasn't there because he had planned his mother's funeral the week before, made me feel a little bit small. But when he was to talk about his personal best leadership experience, that would be it. at 19 years of age, that would be it. He was the last of the youngest of five kids, the only one still at home, the one who found his mom. Father couldn't handle it, and he was the one who gathered the family together, planned the funeral, took care of a whole bunch of things. Well, Ignacio's has gone on to do other kinds of things, but at that point in his life, that was his personal best experience. So you think about what might have been, might be, and still will be your personal best experience. Think about it this way. We ask thousands of people to tell us about their personal best experience. And what would you say? What would you say if I told you that everybody has a story to tell? And just think about this at a macro level. You're a leadership scholar, and you find out that when you ask people to tell you about your personal best experience, everybody's got a story to tell. And when you listen to their stories, you find out that what they're talking about, the actions and behaviors, are more similar than they are different. If those were the only two pieces of data that you had, what conclusions would you draw as a scholar of leadership? What conclusions would you draw? Yeah, I mean, just think about it. Everybody has a story to tell. It somehow suggests that leadership is not something that's out there. It's not like all the people who are not here are not leaders. The leaders are here. No, the leaders are here. They're there. They're over there. They're over there. They're not just in Seattle. They're in other parts of the continent, the planet. They're all over the place. What would it be like if you took this data and you said, hey, everybody's capable of leadership. Everybody's capable of leadership. Even my roommates, they're capable of leadership. And when you are leading, the actual behaviors, the things that you do as a leader, there's some commonalities there. There's some things that everybody does. Whether they have long hair or short hair, these are the things that people do when they're leading and making a difference. And that leads us to understand that leadership is within the capacity of everyone. It's understandable, it's observable, and therefore it's learnable, which is how many of us here in the room make our living, by teaching leadership. With the premise that my meta premise in teaching a class on leadership is not so much the content, but is the gestalt, that you should leave this room tonight believing that you are a leader already and that you make a difference already. Of course, it's also true. You still got to want to do this. I can't make you a leader. All of us teachers in the room, we can teach, only you can learn. We can teach, only you can learn. It also requires good coaching, good teachers, good coaches. And then it requires lots of practice. You don't get better at anything without practicing. You practice and you practice and you practice. Well, so I want to tell you tonight about the results of more than your whole life. I've been thinking about this stuff. Thousands of cases, millions of surveys, data from all around the world. I want to tell you what we've learned. I'll tell you what we call the five practices of exemplary leadership. So what are those behaviors and actions that people are engaged in when they're at their personal best? Let me tell you a little bit about each of these, and let me tell you a little bit about something you can do right now without anybody's permission. No need for a budget. Things that you can do right now to demonstrate leadership. Model the way. Now, remember, when people told us when they're at their personal best, no one said, and I modeled the way. No, what they told us was that they led by example. What they told us was that they didn't ask anybody to do something they weren't willing to do themselves. What they said was, I set an example for others. I was clear about what I wanted to accomplish, and I was driven and committed to achieve it. That's what people say. We call it modeling the way. If tonight was a different kind of night, a night in which we were all here to meet our new leader, our new manager, our new vice president, our new coach, whoever it might be, every one of us would have some questions for that new leader. But what do you think would be the most frequent question? The question that most people want to ask is a variation of the question of, who the heck are you? I mean, if I'm going to follow you, I want to know who you are. See, leadership fundamentally is a relationship between those who would lead and those who would follow. And do any of you have relationships? When you develop a relationship, how do you develop a relationship? Through a series of questions. Not quite as bold as, well, so who are you? But you might ask a question like, what kind of sports do you like? What kind of movies do you like? What kind of food do you like? What kind of family are you from? What do you like to do in your free time? These things fundamentally are about who you are and trying to find some common ground and trying to find a reason why I'd like to be in a relationship with you. Who are you? And if that's what people fundamentally want to know from us, then we got to know it for ourselves. Who am I? What is important to me? What do I care about? Why did I take this job? What do I want to accomplish? How do I feel about people? When you look in the mirror, Michael Jackson asked in one of his songs, you know, the man in the mirror. When you look in the mirror, what do you see? Because when you look in the mirror, the question is, who do you see? See, do you see a leader? Do you see yourself as somebody that can make a difference? See, because who's the first person that's got to follow you? Anybody know who that person is? It's not the person sitting next to you. Who's the first person that's got to follow you? Yeah, it's you. First person that's got to believe in you is you. Because if you don't believe in yourself, it's hard to imagine anybody else would believe in you. The first voice of doubt that you have to deal with is the little voice inside of yourself that says, hey, if this is such a good idea, how come I thought of it? How come somebody else hasn't thought about it? How come somebody more experienced than I hasn't thought about it? Somebody that's done this before hasn't thought about it. The coach hasn't thought about it. The manager hasn't thought about it. If we don't believe in it ourselves, it's hard to imagine. In fact, it's hard to imagine. Remember, leadership is a relationship. It's hard to imagine that you can be a leader if there's nobody following you, nobody going with you. You're just out for a walk in the park. But you got to take some kind of action to galvanize others to want to follow you. What we find is that the model we set with our actions far more powerful than anything we can say. The model we set with our actions is far more powerful than anything we say. I can say we're going to clap on three, but you follow what I do. I can say we need to be kind to people, and then you listen to how I treat other people. So we got to be clear about this. What we know empirically in our surveys, we ask this question. How frequently does your leader, your manager, follow through on their promises and commitments? And then we ask, how much do you trust your management? And I'm going to show you just snapshots, all of which look like this. That's my point, just a visual point. Is that the more you engage as a leader, the more frequently you do something like this, follow through on your promises and commitments. I said we're going to clap on three, and I clap on three. The more I do that, the more you trust me. So we must be sure to follow through on our promises and our commitments. When we do that, it allows us to be better at modeling the way, being clear about who we are. And in that process, making sure that we're intentionally linking our actions with our values. So the reasons why we do this at Seattle University is because we believe da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We believe people are da-da-da-da, and therefore we treat them this way. In our judicial system, we believe that people are innocent until they're proven guilty, and we treat them in that way, however challenging that may be at some times. And all the studies of law enforcement challenge that, particularly in the civil unrest that we experience around the country these days. Being intentional. I'm taking this action because I believe. Because I believe, I'm taking this action. And leaders inspire a shared vision. And once again, nobody said, hey, Barry, when I was in my personal best, I inspired a shared vision. No, what they said was, I had a vision, I had a goal, I had an objective, I had a mission, I had a purpose. We asked Andy Grove, one of the founders of Intel, about, you know, when they were starting Intel, what was his vision? Andy, a hard-boiled scientist, said, I didn't have a vision. I had a burning agenda. Call it what you will, but there's some future orientation. There's some aspiration. That's really what a vision is. It's an aspiration about the future being better than what's today. And it's about getting others to see what you see, to share it. Martin Luther King said, I have a dream. I have this dream. But in order for us to achieve this dream, here's what we will have to do. And in my dream, I see my children hand in hand with your children walking down the street. I don't just see my kids. I see all of our kids. I want this to be one that we share. And I want to do that in a way that's inspiring. And you know what the word inspire literally means? Again, look it up in the dictionary. How about this? Anybody know what the word expire means? Okay, this one you know. Yeah. So inspire is just the opposite, to breathe life into. How do we breathe life in? How do we get people excited about the things we're excited about? Well, one of the things we do is we're trying to be, what one nursing supervisor said, I was contagiously enthusiastic. I was so excited about this new technique that we were going to do here in the hospital that my enthusiasm just got other people excited about it. And they said, well, if she's excited about it, I guess we should be excited about it, and let's give it a go. Can't help but think about some of your teachers. How inspiring are they? How enthusiastic. You know, we do at Santa Clara. I'm sure you do this here. End of the quarter, you give an evaluation to the students about how you thought the instructor was that quarter. The single question that predicts almost one-to-one the student's overall rating of the instructor is the answer to this question. How enthusiastic is the instructor about the subject material? Instructors who are enthusiastic about the material that they're teaching tend to have the highest teaching evaluations, tend to have the students who are most turned on. We have 12 different instructors that teach calculus. Talk about an exciting, let's figure out the area under the curve. Won't this be interesting? And yet some of those teachers make it interesting, make the students in their sections understand that this is something useful and important. Well, the first question people want to ask is, who are you? The second question typically is some variation of, so where are we going? Or what's going to be different? Or are we going to have to change? Or what do you want to accomplish that we're now not doing? So it's about who you are first. And now that I know who you are, well, do I want to go out with you? So I like you, but I'm not sure I want to go out with you. Where do you want to go? What do you want to do? I've only been here a week and it never rains here. It's never misty here. It's always clear. Is that your experience? So you're driving along, and all of a sudden you hit a fog bank, a downpour of rain. If you're a psychologically healthy driver, what would you do?
Slow down.
Thank you. You'd slow down. What else might you do? Yeah, turn on the windshield wipers. Absolutely. What else might you do? Fog lights. Absolutely. What else might you do? Turn the radio off. Stop texting. You might grip the wheel with both hands. You might even lean forward 3 or 4 inches as if this will make a difference. Now I can see a lot closer. See, think about what you're capable of doing, and then you can't see ahead. And think about when you can't see ahead, what happens to people? They don't do what they're capable of doing. Because then things clear up. And what do? You sit back, you relax, you turn the radio on, start making phone calls, and away you go. So you and I, if we want to get the most out of people, we got to help them see the future. We got to help them see what's ahead. The data shows that when leaders can help people see how their long-term interests. See, first day of class, I give you a syllabus. And one of the reasons I do that is so that you can see, here's where we're going. And you can see why it would be of use for you to learn whatever the subject matter is. If I can't convince you of that kind of in the first couple classes, then you and I are in for a long 10 weeks, aren't we? Because you never see the purpose of all of this. You don't see yourself in the picture of what you could do knowing calculus or knowing chemistry or knowing accounting, whatever the subject might be. Here's another example. Dean Joseph Phillips told me that there were some very capable people here in the room. He didn't mention all of you, but that there were some very capable people here in the room. So I'm going to suggest that I have this puzzle. It has 500 pieces. You can see all the pieces are still in the bag. So this is not a trick. All the pieces are still in the bag. So I'm going to give you all the resources you need to solve this problem, to put the puzzle together. Okay? Now, then I'm going to leave the room. But before I leave the room, is there anything else you want to know from me? Anything else you want to know from me? I gave you all that you need to do to put this together. Anything else you want to know from me? Yeah, what's it supposed to look like when it's all over? You don't have to describe it specifically, Barry, but is it a flower? Is it a garden? Is it a person? Is it something I'm familiar with? Is it an animal? Is this thing square or circular? Just tell me some of those kinds of things, and you know, I can be a lot more effective than just given all the pieces and then told, I mean, I don't know. Have you ever been told, just do your best? What the heck's that supposed to mean? Give me a little bit more help with understanding what is my best and what would it look like? What kind of information do people want to know more from their management? No matter where you are in the organization, you can be the president reporting to the CEO reporting to the board. You can be a frontline receptionist. The thing you want to know, and again, I think the analogs are quite clear for all of us that are students. You want to know, where is this class? Where's this organization? Where's this project heading? And how does what I do fit into the total picture? And if you can't answer those questions for yourself and your team, then you've just described what psychologists call alienation in the workplace. People are alienated in the workplace because they have no sense of purpose and they have no idea that what they do matters. And if it's true that what you do doesn't matter, then, well, Barry, is this going to be on the test? Well, then you don't show up for class. Who cares? I don't need to know this stuff. It's all in the book. No value added in the coming to the classroom. How does my job fit into this? Researchers find that those people who can find meaning and significance in the work that they're doing are more satisfied and more motivated and more engaged than those who are just working. I know as an instructor, and you know it too, there's a great difference between students who are in a required class versus an elective class. You know it yourself. I got to take this class versus, oh, I think this class might be interesting, and I signed up for it. I heard good things about it. And all of a sudden, it works for both of us, you and me. Oh, no, I got to teach this class with a whole bunch of people who don't want to be here. Required class. Or I get to teach a class on the subject I really love, and presumably the students who are in the class are students who are interested in this topic. We're going to have a lot more fun. Same thing happens in the workplace. So to be the best leader you can be when it comes to inspiring a shared vision, start with the end in mind. What are you trying to accomplish? What does the future look like? And how can you help people see that future? Here's where knowing the area under a curve, how to calculate it, might be important to you. Being able to differentiate, you know, empirically between A and B might be helpful to you when you're doing a marketing test of a product or a brand. It might also be important for you to articulate the why. Why are we doing this? Why do I have to know this? Why do I have to do this? Why do I have to show up? Why do I have to be there? Why do I have to participate? Well, if there's no answer to this, why? I don't know. Well, I don't know. You don't know. We're not going to make a go of it. Leaders challenge the process, right? Managers hold on. Leaders let go. Instead of risking anything new, the cartoon says, let's play it safe by continuing our slow decline into obsolescence. Right? This is a well-run bankruptcy. We'll just see how well we can run it into the ground. If we're going to get better than we are today, it requires us to do things differently. It was Einstein who said years ago that imagination is really more important than intelligence, but he's also been quoted as kind of saying it's insane to think that you can get better by doing the same thing over and over and over again. If it's not working, you got to try something new. And major problems go unsolved because they seem to be they're too big, they're too overwhelming. I'm just one person. The task for us is to motivate performance by showing people that they're making progress. You know, climate. We're going to solve the climate problem in the next 30 days, 30 months, 30 years, 30 lifetimes. I don't know. But we need to feel like we're making some progress. Otherwise, we're going to lose our motivation and give up and lose our hope. We really call this small wins, trying to help people feel small wins. In some ways, that's what a midterm is supposed to be. A quiz is supposed to be this. A midterm is supposed to be this. An opportunity for you to see how well you're doing. I mean, you tell me, how many of you like to take a class in which there's only one assignment at the end of the quarter? Most of us like to know how we're doing. Partly we want to know how we're doing so that then we can correct ourselves. There's an interesting study years ago done about bowling. You remember bowling? Anybody bowling? You know, bowling. So they take a whole bunch of people who've never gone bowling before, and they introduce them to the game. And one group they videotape all of them. But one group, they show after they've been bowling, they show them some videotapes of them doing things right. You know, when they didn't get a gutter ball and when they threw it down and got a lot of pins knocked over. In the other group, they showed them just all the things that they were doing wrong, all the times that they messed up. And then afterwards, they asked the two groups, so how many of you want to continue learning to bowl? Which group do you think wanted to continue? Well, the group that saw themselves being successful. Group that saw themselves being successful felt like they were, well, I could do this. How hard can this be? Look how well I did the first time. And those people who didn't do very well, they didn't do any better or worse than the other group, but they just were feeling like they couldn't do better. So where do new ideas come from? Well, I'm here to tell you they come from Santa Clara University. So Joe, thank you for inviting me here so I could share some of those ideas. Now, the truth of the matter is they come from everywhere. In fact, the truth of the matter is no great idea ever enters the mind through an open mouth. Great ideas come from listening, which is why I appreciate how attentive you've all been. Listening to yourself, believing in yourself, and listening to those around you. There are all kinds of clues. Sherlock Holmes once solved a case simply because he realized that the dog was not barking. Therefore, the dog must have known whoever it was that entered the yard. Do you know the origin of these products? Somebody just didn't go out and say, hey, I think I'll make a Frisbee. Or nobody went out and said, I think, you know, Post-it notes, that'd be a great idea. How about Costco? We thought of the idea of Costco. Where did that come from? Stole it from the Price Club and then improved upon it. Frisbees, a college game using pie tins. Took them right out of the dormitory, the cafeteria, throwing them around. Somebody said, well, those aluminum metal kinds of things hurt. Maybe we could come up with something that would be softer. That's a billion-dollar industry. Martial arts weapons? Well, samurais had swords, steel. Farmers had hoes and chains. And those were the weapons that they used. Masking tape came about because people were observing how it was that painters, you know, painted cars and how they masked different parts of the car. Now we got frog tape, you know, and all kinds of different things that you can do. Post-it notes originally came from a fellow at 3M, which is a kind of a sticky company, you know, making scotch tape and all that stuff. And yet he was in the church choir, And they were just putting a little piece of paper in the big hymn book, try to keep their place, and then they would lose some of those things. And he thought, you know, in the lab, we had this thing that didn't permanently stick. Maybe we could use that and another billion-dollar industry. And Velcro simply was a fellow who was walking, with his dog. And we've all done this, walk through a field or something and get those burrs in your pants or on your clothes. But you never looked at it through a microscope to kind of figure out, oh, I can see what's holding those two things together. And I wonder if there might be some other uses besides, messing up my pants and messing up my dog. Leaders are constantly asking what's new, what's next, what's better. I hope that's why you're here. What's new, what's next, what's better. When it comes to challenging the process, you want to support experimentation, focusing as much on the learning as on the results. I mean, even Caitlin Clark doesn't make 100% of her shots, but she keeps shooting. And pay attention and improve your listening skills, especially to what's happening outside of you. There's a real word for that, by the way. It's called outsight. It's the cousin of insight. Not seeing inside of yourself, but seeing outside of yourself. You came here tonight to hear from this guy from, some other place. What might he have to say that would be relevant to me? And leaders enable others to act. Leadership is not, you don't do it all by yourself. No one ever told us about a time they've been at their personal best and said, and I did this all by myself. I mean, even as researchers and scholars, we build upon all the work that's done before us. We didn't do it all by ourselves. I don't know if you or your family's ever rented a car, but if you have, you rented the car, and before you returned it, how many of you got it washed? No neat nicks here? You're just expecting it's going to rain so it'll take care of itself? Is that the Seattle way of doing things? Well, here again, another one of those T-ball, softball questions. Why don't we wash rental cars? Because they aren't ours. They are not ours. Why would we do something that, why would we take responsibility for something that's not ours? That's what we pay Hertz or Enterprise or Alamo. We pay them. It's not my job. It's not my room. It wasn't my mess. It's not my garbage. I didn't do that, but I could do something about it, but I don't own it. See, we need to make sure that people feel like they own it. It's their responsibility. Because people who feel a sense of responsibility are more liable to take responsibility. Here's an example of that. I like to share this in particular because I want you to know that even though it's Sunday, I'm reading the Sunday paper, but I'm still thinking about leadership. So Charlie Schulz is writing one day. He says, okay, troops, in the form of Snoopy, he says, okay, troops, gather around. Who is it? It's me. I'm the leader, so I have my picture on the flag. Pretty traditional thought. He says, just think how this is going to inspire you as we march along. Now he's getting, all this feedback from, some first-year Seattle University students. He says, all right, does anybody have a better idea? And there's that better idea. Now, there's something, quite obvious. The better idea is everybody's got their picture on the flag. It's not just Snoopy. But there's another subtle point. If I make all of you powerful today, is that going to mean that I'm less powerful? If I make everybody on my team feel like they're a leader, does that mean that somehow I'm not the leader? So we can make everybody, a high-performing team is when everybody feels like they're a leader. A high-performing organization is in which everybody feels that no matter what job they're doing, this place would not be so good if it wasn't for the job that they're doing. And whether they're the frontline receptionist, I'm at a fundraiser for one of our community hospitals, and I'm meeting some fellow, and he's talking to me about how great the hospital is. Later on, I asked somebody else, who was that guy? Well, he was going on and on about how great this hospital is. And the person says, yeah, well, that guy's in charge of HVAC. He's in charge of heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. I would have thought he was the chief of surgery. I'm doing an in-service for a school district. We're talking about the same things. Guy raises his hand. He says, Barry, what my group does, we're the most important group here in the school district. Well, I already know the superintendent, so I know he's not the superintendent. I wonder what it is that he does. He says, I'm in charge of transportation. We run the bus system. If we don't get the kids to school, it doesn't make a difference how good the teachers are, how nice the place looks, how good the food in the cafeteria is. For goodness sakes, we want every group in that organization to say, and we're important, and we make a difference. If the food we serve in the cafeteria doesn't meet the kids' needs, we're gonna have anarchy. If we don't get good teachers, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. If we can't keep the facilities clean and safe and sanitary, then we've got problems. Everybody's got to feel that what they do is important. You got to make people feel strong and capable, and that's the heart of trust. See, I want to be in a relationship with somebody who wants me to be the best version of who I am. And for those of you that haven't experienced it yet, that's essentially what love is all about. To care more for somebody else than you care for yourself. And every mother and father would say to God, take my arm, don't take my child's. That's what love's about. And that's the kind of relationship we want to have in an organization, that people care about us and want us to be all that we can be, to be the best version of ourselves. And when leaders give people a great deal of freedom and choice in deciding how it is to do their work, believe in them and trust them, then people are proud to tell others that they work for this organization. And you can see just how dramatic it is the more frequently leaders engage in this behavior. So to be the best leader you can be, provide experiences that enable people to develop their competence and their confidence. I put a piece of timber here on the ground, 10 feet long. I ask you to walk on it. It's 11 inches wide, and you all walk quite comfortably. I take that, something you can do. I take that same timber, and I just put it from one chair to another chair. That's only 3 feet off the ground. And yet, the speed and the confidence of what you just did goes down dramatically. Unless maybe I put a belay on you. Maybe I put some cushions on the ground to make sure that in case you fall, you won't hurt yourself. See, I need to develop both your competence and your confidence. And finally, and this is not a step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But when people are at their personal best, they also talk about the importance of encouraging the heart. The root of the word encourage is, in fact, courage. We're going to ask people to do things that they've never done before. There must be a reason why they're not doing them. Because they're afraid. Because they might be embarrassed. They might feel like they could get hurt. Oh, I can't do that. They'll fire me. So you don't do it. So we got to give people the courage to do things that they didn't think that they could do. But I'll tell you this. All of us are bigger than our job descriptions and are more capable than we give ourselves credit for. Empirically, if I ask an audience of 100 people, do you need encouragement to perform at your best? The answer is either yes or no. I get about 50% of the people who say, yes, I need encouragement. People who say no, you know why they say no? Well, Barry, I don't need encouragement because I'm an adult. Barry, I don't need encouragement. I'm a Seattle University graduate. Barry, I don't need encouragement. I'm a professional. So then we realize we're asking the question incorrectly. What do you think happens when we ask the second question? If I say to you, when you receive encouragement, does it help stimulate and sustain your performance? Now, what percentage of the people do you think raise their hands? Nearly everybody. Not everybody, because some people aren't listening. But mostly everybody raises their hand. And now it's just a simple question in logic. Mathematics or logic. If A equals B and B equals C, then A must also equal C. So if 2 is true, then I submit to you that 1 is also true. We don't all need the same variety, the same texture, the same flavor, the same glitz and glimmer. But here, raise your hand, really. How many of you like to be taken for granted? Really, just, it's okay. Yeah, see, doesn't make a difference who you are, what color your hair is, how old you are, what it is that you do. Nobody wants to be taken for granted. Now, granted, we've got to then sort of figure out, I'm dealing with a five-year-old. How do I encourage the five-year-old's heart is different than a 15-year-old and a 25-year-old and a 35-year-old. Somebody just coming out of college, I might deal with differently than somebody that's been on the job for 10 years. But no one wants to be taken for granted. That's not how you sustain a relationship. People want to know that their leaders have confidence in their abilities, and that's why they trust them. Of course, you got to be genuine. Some of you are going to go, you know, back to your roommates or your dorm or your living, you know, and you're going to go, hey, everybody, I just came from a leadership seminar, and I love you all, and keep up the good work, and thank you for what you've been doing, and I'll be back tomorrow. It's not quite that easy. And technology is not going to help us out. This is a new AI kind of opportunity to make people feel good. You know, researchers have studied teams of people, you know, who are doing kind of the same work. And what they find is that in high-performing teams, people give themselves a 5 to 6 more positive comments against every criticism or negative comment. They're just full of, I mean, I don't know, you ever watched, you can see this very easily in a volleyball match. You ever seen a volleyball match? They're always saying good things about their teammates. Good hit, good block, even if the block went out, even if the hit went into the net. Medium performing teams, it's about 2 to 1. And more often they say good things than they do say bad things. What do you think happens in the lowest performing teams? I know you've had no personal experience with this, but if you ever did, here's what researchers find. Low-performing teams, they spend a lot of time complaining about everybody else. You know, I could have done this if it wasn't for you, and if it wasn't for you, and if you had done this, and if you had done that, and if you had done, it's all about, you know, all this finger-pointing about all the other things, you know? If the teacher had done this, if the president had done this, if the coach had done this, if they passed me the ball, if they hadn't done that, that's what low-performing teams do. They blame each other. So to be the best leader you can be when it comes to encouraging the heart, well, you got to understand what motivates each individual. You got to personalize it. You got to know whether people like, you know, if it's jewelry, I don't know whether they like gold or silver. You got to know ways to be creative. The thing that makes recognition so routine is when you do the same thing over and over and over again. Or you put this in a spreadsheet. Ever done this? Put this in a spreadsheet, days of the week here, people's names here. And you sort of say, well, let's see, I haven't said anything nice about my one of my roommates now for a few days. I guess it's his turn. I'll say something nice. Generally, we do better when we make the recognition public because there's an audience that looks up to those role models. We get involved personally. We don't delegate it to somebody else. And finally, we recognize people for doing the right things all the way back to modeling the way. What was the standard? What was the value? We're giving this recognition today to Meredith. We're giving it to Meredith because she went out of her way to get those lab results to the client in a way that she didn't have to. She actually, you know, got them, she called them, she did these kinds of things above and beyond the call of duty. And that's what it means, people, when we say we really care about people. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Model the way starts with kind of who you are as a leader. Inspiring a shared vision is, so where are you going to go? Challenge the process, well, what's going to have to be different? If we're going to get to this different place, what's going to have to change now? And how do I set up this team for success? Because I know I'm important, but I can't do it all by myself. So how do I make, it's the paradox of leaders turning their followers into leaders. And finally, how do I keep the team engaged and motivated and encouraged and energized along the way? Because the climb to the top is always difficult. If it wasn't difficult, we'd all be at the top. So how do I make sure that I can sustain and encourage people to continue to do their best. Well, as I said, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. Those 2 hours went by very quickly now, haven't they? Some of you who are worried about that. I want to thank again Joe Phillips and others for inviting me to share these thoughts with you, for your instructors requiring you to come here tonight and writing all those papers. So with that, let's call it a night. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Leadership Playbook, the podcast edition of the Albers Executive Speaker Series at Seattle University. If you enjoyed what you heard today, consider telling a friend and give us a good rating on iTunes. You can subscribe to our show for free on your favorite podcast app or find us online at leadershipplaybook.org. Find out who our next guests are by following us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Joe Phillips, the Dean of the Albers School of Business and Economics. Thanks for listening.